Okay, I'm going to call into order this hearing of the Senate Committee on Workforce and General Government. Welcome, everyone. Today is Tuesday, February 9th, 2016. And we have a couple of issues that we'll be dealing with today that we'll have public hearings on and scheduled for possible work sessions. We have a work session scheduled also for the Wage Enforcement Bill, Senate Bill 1587. We have what I believe are consensus amendments around that bill. However, the process has intervened to make it impossible for us to have those amendments today. So I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 1587 to Thursday, and when we'll be in a position, I think, to vote on it. So I'm going to open up first. We'll deal first with Senate Bill 1579, and then we'll go to Senate Bill 1526. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1579. I'll ask Senators Whitsitt and Courtney, do you want to come up together? And while Jan explains the bill to us, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that requires state agencies to provide the summary of legal advice regarding the validity or the effect of proposed rule or written order. And it applies to orders issued and a rulemaking notice given on or after the effective date and declares an emergency effective on passage. And there are no amendments before you.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt, would you like to kick it off?
Thank you, Chair Denver, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Doug Whitsitt, state senator from District 28, Southern Oregon. On my right is a learned barrister from West Virginia. On the left is a learned barrister from Eastern Oregon. I'm a country vet. Okay. So, as you know, the Oregon Department of Justice represents state agency boards and commissions in legal matters. When the Attorney General responds to a request for a legal opinion, the Attorney General's written opinion is public record. However, when an agency board or commission asks for legal advice from the Department of Justice attorney, the advice received is protected from disclosure unless the disclosure is specifically authorized by the agency board or commission requesting the advice. So, Oregon Revised Statute 183.335 requires that an agency shall include all of the following when it issues a notice of intended action related to the adoption, amendment, or repeal of a rule. First, it must make a citation of the statutory or legal authority relied upon and bearing upon the promulgation of the rule. Second, the citation of the statute or other law the rule is intended to implement. And finally, a list of the principal documents, reports, or studies, if any, prepared by or relied upon by the agency in considering the need for the preparation of the rule. One would think that the statutory language was sufficient to require an agency to disclose all of the information that they rely upon to make a rule. It is not. Agencies are instead asking for legal advice from their attorneys and then refusing to include the content of that legal advice in the notice of intended action. The first change to ORS 183.335 will amend Section 1BF to require a summary of any legal advice received by the agency regarding the validity or the effect of the rules. The second change to ORS 183.335 is related to written agency orders. The state agencies routinely base their understanding of the validity or effect of a written order upon legal advice from their attorneys. The agencies are now refusing to reveal either the source or the content of the legal advice based upon protection of attorney-client privilege. So, this means the person who is subject to the written order is unable to discover the legal reasoning, precedents, and conclusions upon which the final order is based. Can you imagine attempting to defend yourself or your property against a written administrative order when there is no way for you or your attorney to discover the legal theories upon which the order is based? Section 3 amends ORS 183.335 to require an order expressed in writing by an agency to include a summary of the legal advice received by the agency regarding the validity or effect of the order. Section 4 provides these two needed changes in current law apply only to written orders or rules issued on or after the effective date of this act. I want to describe a couple of real situations that occurred within the last year that necessitate, I believe, this law. The Oregon Department of Energy alleged it had obtained legal advice authorizing the retroactive promulgation of rules that would allow the sale of business energy tax credits by third parties at steeper discounts than appear to be authorized by law. The agency denied access to the legal advice claiming attorney-client privilege. They denied that access to their own staff, to attorneys that were looking at it, and to the legislature. The Oregon Water Resources Department planned to regulate irrigation wells on the historic Klamath Tribal Reservation in 2014. Questions were brought up whether the agency had legal authority to regulate those wells. The agency did not regulate the wells during the 2014 irrigation season. The agency did regulate the wells during the 2015 irrigation season, and the agency allegedly based its written orders to stop using the wells during 2015 on the legal advice of its Department of Justice attorney. Oregon Water Resources Department has steadfastly refused to disclose the legal advice based on attorney-client privilege, not only to those people who are subject to the orders, but repeatedly to me and my office. Attorney-client privilege has been a time-tested pillar of judicial system since the Roman Empire. This bill is neither intended to nor does it alter protected communication between an attorney and their client. It neither requires disclosure of the communication nor even the source of the legal advice. What it does do, it requires an agency to provide a written condensation of the legal theories and precedents upon which it is basing an administrative rule or written order. Senator Dembrough, Chair Dembrough, and members of the committee, I respectfully urge the committee to pass Senate Bill 1579 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator. President Courtney.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Thatcher, Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Knope, Senator Gelser, Senator, Committee Administrator Nordland. My name is Peter Courtney, and I'm a state senator from District 11, which includes Salem and Jervis and Woodburn. I signed on as a sponsor of this measure for one reason. I'm a public policymaker. I think this committee and the other members of the legislature are public policymakers. People say we're politicians. I say we're public policymakers. We make public policy. That's what we do. One can question the kind of policy we make or we don't make, but that's what we do. I think it is important for us to understand how agencies work. This is the executive branch I'm referring to. The executive branch, when I say agencies, because legislature, public policymaker, then the executive branch. It's important for us to understand why agencies take the action they take if we are going to make good public policies. The legislature and agencies have different roles under our Constitution. Our relationship with the executive branch agencies is by nature adversarial. I've got to be a little careful with that statement. It doesn't mean we're at war all the time or that we should take the view we need to be at war. We just have very distinctive roles in the way we govern ourselves in this state and in this country. This doesn't mean, as I say, that we should be at war, but our role is to oversee the way agencies implement the laws we pass. That is a legislative role, that we pass the laws and how they're implemented, which is the role of the executive branch. We have a responsibility to oversee that. The more we know about how and why agencies do what they do, the better we can do what the voters have asked us to do, which is means to make the laws, and to the extent we are allowed by this constitutional amendment, that's another big issue, to oversee and hopefully make sure they're implemented as we intend. Ultimately, that will lead to a better government and a better service for our people. Many of you have heard me say before that I believe the legislative branch of government is in decline. Now that, I sincerely believe that. I do not believe that the legislative branch of government that I was very honorably elected to in 1980 and have served in this great state is as strong as it once was, and I believe compared to the other two branches, the legislative branch is in decline. Our government is being run more and more by the executive branch and the courts. Now, again, I am not, with that statement, attacking the courts or the executive branch. That is not my intent. I believe it's a natural evolution that that is happening because of the vacuum or inactivity of the branches. I believe that to be the case. That's my opinion. I could be completely wrong as a political scientist. I could be completely wrong as a legislator, but that is my perception in watching this. And I also think it's somewhat of our own responsibility when you look at our failure to staff us, to take some of the support services we need and put them behind us as legislators. I am grateful, even though there are some people here that are no longer grateful, that we are now meeting at least every year. Now, I'm not going to get into that little subject, which has become a very interesting topic of conversation. I supported that for the very reason that I'm on this bill. It gave us a greater role or an equal role to oversee the executive branch. So I am proud of the fact that we meet at least some period of time every year. If we're going to remain a co-equal branch of government, we need to send a message to agencies, not in a threatening way, but at least in a directive way. They need to share the information. They need to work with us rather than against us. I do not know if this bill gets us to that point, but I believe it does begin to send an important message. Off script, I simply believe that this thing is constantly involving this legislative branch, the executive branch, courts. There's a constant balancing that we're trying to find here. How do you balance the two branches so that they can work together, but also play their very, very distinctive roles? And I think that's what's at stake here in this bill. Again, I'm very grateful that the committee will hold a public hearing on it. I think this is an extraordinarily important topic that we should discuss, and hopefully in the end we become a better branch, as well as we have a better working relationship with the courts and the executive branch through this kind of legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and and members of the committee for allowing me to testify.
Thank you for providing that context, Senator. Finally.
Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, my name is Nathan Reitman. I'm a partner with the law firm of Reitman & Reitman, LLP, based here in Salem. In the course of my practice, I regularly interface with state agencies, both in rulemaking proceedings and quasi-judicial proceedings that result in the issuance of orders. And I took an interest in this bill because it kind of gave me the thought there are a few ideas I wanted to share with you. One is that the idea that our system of government is based upon is the idea that the public has the right to know the reasons and information that underline the government's decisions. Our public meeting law is based on the policy that the Oregon form of government requires an informed public aware of the deliberations and decisions of governing bodies and the information upon which such decisions were made. Our judicial system, in which courts issue written opinions explaining their legal reasonings and their decisions, is also in keeping with this idea. And transparency in government is important, and it's particularly important in the context of state agency decision making, where you have unelected public officials legislating through the rulemaking process, acting in a quasi-judicial capacity through the order process, and making decisions that potentially divest people of liberty and property interests. And in the course of my practice, far too often I've encountered situations, whether it's a rulemaking proceeding or a contested case proceeding, where my client will be challenging the legal authority or questioning the legal authority of the agency and asking, you know, does it have the authority to make this decision? What is the anticipated legal effect of this rule? And far too often the answer is, well, we'll go check. It's attorney-client privilege, but we have the authority to do this. And that puts the client to the burden and expense of going to court with no information as to what the basis for the decision was, and a situation in which the rationale underlying that decision is constantly subject to change, and the reason asserted in court may differ from the actual reason that was the basis for the decision at the time. So I don't want to keep you, but this is a real problem. It happens reoccurringly all the time, and I think this bill is a good step in addressing it.
Thank you, all three of you. Colleagues, any questions for the panel? Yes, Senator Gelzer.
I think just a comment, a thank you to all of you for bringing the bill. I think it's important to point out that this does not, it's not asking for a summary of legal advice when there is a court case. This is about the development of the rules, which goes directly to the administration of government. I do think this is an issue that we need to look at more broadly. There it definitely is a tension, and we've certainly seen this recently with the Department of Human Services. When the Department of Justice is involved, is the client the state of Oregon, meaning its people, or is it the agency and the people who have acted within the agency? I believe the Department of Justice needs to be empowered to act on behalf of the people of the state of Oregon, even if there has been a bad actor within the state agency. So I'm glad that this is brought here, and hopefully it will create some more transparency and we can have more clarity about what the Department of Justice has said. That's the last thing as an agency can say. DOJ told us this because of the attorney-client privilege. Even if DOJ did not say that, DOJ may not clarify that that is not, in fact, what they have said.
Chair Denver,
Senator Woodson, yes.
Senator Gelzer, you're absolutely correct. This only applies to administrative law, only to rulemaking, only to contested case orders or final written orders. It doesn't have anything to do with the court itself. Many of the agencies believe that the administrative process really is not a judicial process. It is, and not how many times have we heard this, it's a fact-finding process. Well, if it's a fact-finding process, for goodness sakes, let's share the facts.
And just to clarify, we're not talking here about releasing correspondence that would otherwise be confidential or telephone logs or any of that. It's providing a summary of the legal advice that justifies the order.
Yes, correct.
And also, we're looking at this prospectively, right? That is,
absolutely.
There's an emergency clause, so it'll go into effect right away, but won't apply to cases that are rulings that have already happened. Is that
the Chair Denver, that's absolutely correct. There is no, it is not retroactive. It only is prospective.
Great. Thank you. Yes, Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Whitsitt, thank you for bringing this before us. And my question is about the last part of the bill that deals with orders in contested case hearings. So we've set up this entire entity that I think are on the advisory committee of the Office of Administrative Hearings, and that's my understanding where most of these orders come from when they're contested. So would this apply to the Office of Administrative Hearings, orders that come out of those administrative proceedings?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Rosenbaum. Yes, the Office of Administrative Hearing oversees administrative law and hires and manages all of the administrative law judges. So, yes, it would apply to that administrative process. And one of the things that I have worked on that committee that Senator Courtney was kind enough to put me on years ago is to try to improve discovery within that process. And incrementally, in little tiny steps, we're moving that direction. I believe this bill will move it a little bit further to allow the people who are subject to those administrative laws to have a clear understanding of the validity and what those administrative laws and rules and contested orders are based upon.
And I guess just a follow-up, I'm trying to figure out how this would work, because when I've looked at those kinds of decisions, they usually are structured like legal opinions. They've got findings of fact and conclusions of law, so they usually state what that objective hearings officer thinks the law is. So is there some additional requirement under this bill that the hearings officer would have to include a summary of something else, or would it be just what we already do in the decision? Or if somebody else, maybe a practitioner, is more familiar with how that works.
Well, I guess the way I would envision it working is not in the situation where the hearings officer issues the final decision, like you said, that's usually pretty well reasoned and written out, much like a court decision. But when the agency that writes the order that becomes the basis for that contested case proceeding issues that order, it would need to, if there's a particular legal standard that was applied to justify the issuance of the order, it would need to have a summary justifying what that standard is and what the advice was as far as, you know, what the standard is that they applied. I think that would be an example.
Any further questions of the panel? Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for bringing this bill, and thank you for your help in our understanding of it. So we have Marianne Nash, please. And he just.
That was that gentleman. Mm-hmm.
And Judy Gyres and Paul Garahan. Thank you. Marianne, you want to start?
Sure. Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash, here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau. And we're here today in support of the bill. I think the bill is addressing a really important issue. As an attorney that interacts closely with agencies in rulemaking, it is often difficult to know and to respond to the legal position of the agency if you have a differing interpretation of a statute and what is allowed under a statute. Oftentimes, I don't find myself until well after I've submitted comments in a rulemaking kind of fully understanding the basis for the agency's legal position, and it makes it very difficult to respond. I definitely understand the attorney-client privilege concerns that I'm sure you're going to hear raised by the folks next to me, but I do think that we need to find a better process for ensuring that people in the regulated community that are interfacing with agencies as they develop rulemaking have the opportunity to fully understand what the legal position of the agency is and respond, so that our commissions are making more informed decisions as they move forward and not just getting one side of the story as they develop rules.
Thank you.
Yes.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, my name is Judy Gyres. I'm the Deputy Chief Counsel of the General Counsel Division. With me is Paul Garahan. He's the attorney in charge for the Natural Resource Section. We're happy to answer your questions, and we have a few concerns that we'd like to voice about the bill. We acknowledge that there may be problems with the way agencies promulgate rules or issue orders, and that people on the other side of those may have concerns about why the agency is doing that. We're happy to talk about ways to fix those problems, but this bill does not seem to be the way to do that to us. The Department of Justice has both practical and legal concerns about this bill. Our main concern is that the bill will fundamentally undermine the attorney-client relationship between our agency clients and our lawyers. It will interfere with our ability to communicate fully and frankly with our agency clients. And that full and frank discussion is critical to our ability to advise the agencies adequately and comprehensively. We believe that without that kind of full and frank discussion, the state's legal exposure will be increased significantly. We are also concerned that the bill will increase the cost of legal advice, and that the bill will generate needless litigation over whether the summary of advice required by the bill is adequate. In any such litigation over whether that summary is adequate, our full legal advice will be disclosed, destroying any attorney-client privilege that might theoretically have survived the disclosure of the summary. The bill fundamentally undermines our attorney-client privilege. The attorney-client privilege is the oldest evidentiary privilege in the law. As Representative Whitsitt said, it dates back to the Roman Empire. It is based on the long-accepted understanding that in order for a lawyer to give good advice, the lawyer needs to know everything related to the matter. In order to get clients to feel comfortable about telling us everything related to the matter, they need to know that nothing they say to us will be revealed to anyone else, and that any advice we provide will be confidential. Without that cone of silence around communications between lawyers and clients, those communications will not be full and open, and as a direct result, the legal advice provided by the Department of Justice will not be as comprehensive or as effective as it could be. Attorney-client privilege is lost, or waived, we say, when the client, and this is a quote, voluntarily discloses or consents to disclosure of any significant part of the matter or communication, meaning the legal advice given to the client. Now, recognize that that is the client's privilege. It's not DOJ who chooses to waive the privilege. It's the client, so the agency. Under that interpretation, under any interpretation of that language, any significant part, a summary of the legal advice provided to the agency will waive the attorney-client privilege. This is our biggest concern. Once that privilege is lost, so once the privilege has been waived by the summary, then all attorney-client information related to the rule or the order will be eligible for disclosure under the public records law. The public records law protects attorney-client privilege because the privilege is there. Once the privilege is gone, then everything is open to the public records law. And in any lawsuit against a state agency. So the concern that was voiced a little bit earlier about whether this would affect actual litigation against the state, the answer is yes, it will. Much of the litigation against the state is based on an agency's rules or orders. If DOJ advice related to the issuance of those rules or the issuance of the order or amendments to rules, for instance, needs to be summarized for some kind of public consumption, then that will waive the privilege. And that will mean that all of the DOJ advice that we provided over perhaps months and months of advising the client on, say, a complicated order or a complicated new set of rules, all of that will be waived. Now, what we do as lawyers, we don't just give agencies a sort of thumbs up or thumbs down. What we do, they come to us with complicated questions. The easy stuff, they don't even ask us. So they come with complicated stuff, and we look at all the different options available to the agency in order for them to do what it is they think they need to do. And we evaluate, you know, say, five different options. And we talk about the risks that those options pose, sort of the benefits and the risks. So when our advice gets into the hands of the opponents, it can provide a roadmap for their challenge to state actions. That roadmap, granted, saves people a lot of time and effort. They don't have to go get their own lawyers to figure this stuff out. But for us, that knowing that we are going to have to produce a roadmap can affect the way we treat our clients. One of our concerns, is that the clients will stop calling us. If they understand that if they ask DOJ for advice, then any advice is going to be summarized and become public, and so they won't have any attorney-client privilege related to that advice, they may not ask us. We, as lawyers, think that's a really bad idea. We think that that exposes the state to more legal risk. But even for us, if we know that we are going to have to summarize our advice in an effort to protect clients against the kind of roadmap that we don't want to provide to opposing counsel, we may find ourselves pulling our punches, not including comprehensive discussions of various risks and benefits. And our concern here is that the attorney-client relationship is pretty sacrosanct. I mean, the attorney-client privilege is older than the priest-penitent privilege. It's older than the doctor-patient privilege. And the reason for that is that for centuries, people have understood that the way to make the legal system work is to give people access to good legal advice. And if you take away that ability for us and for the agencies to communicate fully and freely, our main concern is that we will not have the ability, because they won't tell us or because we'll feel hampered, to provide that full and comprehensive advice. Aside from that, there are a couple of other things that are worth noting. The bill itself is quite vague about what is a summary of legal advice. However, the law into which this amendment would go provides for challenging a rule if the agency has not substantially complied with the procedural requirements in the law. So that would mean that if somebody felt that our summary of advice was not sufficiently comprehensive, they could challenge the implementation of the rule, not based on the fact that the rule is outside the agency's authority, not based on the fact that the rule is unfair or unreasonable, but simply based on the fact that the summary of the legal advice related to the rule is not comprehensive. That starts an entire process of rule challenge, which could delay the implementation of rules for years. It would be very expensive. I don't think that anybody intended that to happen, so that's something to take a look at.
You had one last concern, Ms. Gears. Just trying to move things along.
Yeah. Let me turn it over to Mr. Garahan to see if he wants to add anything.
Thank you.
I would just add a couple things. First, I note Chair Dembrough and Senator Rosenbaum.
Oh, yes. Sorry, Mr. Garahan.
Oh,
could you please
me.
Give your name in your own voice?
Yes. Please. Sorry. I'm Paul Garahan. I'm the attorney in charge of the Natural Resources Section at the Department of Justice.
Thank you.
Chair Dembrough, in response to Senator Rosenbaum's question earlier about the implication on providing a summary related to agency orders, it is not just in the contested case arena where that would apply. As used in the Administrative Procedures Act, the word order essentially means any decision that the agency makes that affects an individual outside the agency. In some cases, agencies provide opportunities for contested cases. And in fact, in those settings, when agencies are making decisions and providing the opportunity for a contested case, they are required to set forth very clearly, and the Office of Administrative Hearings sticks them to this, very clearly, what's the provision of law that form the basis of the, or multiple provisions of law that form the basis for the decision that was made that would be going to contested case. But it's also lots of other orders where sometimes a contested case isn't provided, which can be challenged in circuit court. So there could be other instances where there could be challenges to orders. So it's both in the rulemaking process and orders. And I note that this really, from the Natural Resource Agency perspective that my section advises, it's working in a highly contentious area where there are very strong feelings on all sides of issues. And frequently agencies are faced with challenges to their decisions from diametrically opposed perspectives. And it runs the gamut. The Energy Facility Siting Council goes through multi-year processes to try to site an energy facility, issuing orders all along the way, and interpreting the law and getting legal advice all along the way. And having to provide a summary, again, would provide a roadmap to opponents who are trying to find any reason possible. Similarly, the Department of State Lands issuing removal fill permits. Permits are orders, and they can be challenged. So again, very contentious sometimes. Advice we might provide to the Department of Forestry related to timber sales, for example, and compliance with the Endangered Species Act. Highly contentious issues where We are advising within, you know, complex areas of the law to make sure they understand the risks of various actions, and, you know, help them try to make the best policy choice they can in these areas. And for us to have to provide that summary of our legal advice would give the opponents who want to try to stop the state from trying to implement the programs that the legislature has directed the agencies to implement, would slow it down, hamstring the agencies from accomplishing the policy goals of those programs. We'd be happy to answer any other questions you may have.
Thank you. Thank you all. Yes, Senator Gelser, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to narrow back to the issue of rulemaking. Okay. It's and the word opponent was used. When rules are promulgated under statute to implement the programs that we pass here, it seems that should be a public process with all of that information available to everyone. The only opponents would be the general public and the legislature. So as it relates to rulemaking, it's very difficult for the legislature to respond to problems when we don't know what it is that's driving an agency. I do most of my work in the Department of Human Services. We have issues right now around senior care providers, 14 deaths in 3 years, and the majority of those licensed providers still have their licenses. I'm told that's because of the rules we have. How come? Because they can't say it, because of attorney-client privilege. How can we fix problems if nobody can tell us what the problem is that's driving the outcomes that we don't want? And when you're moving into areas like human services and there's lives that are at risk, what is your suggestion for how we get at that information so we know what the policies are that are in the way of keeping people safe? Because right now it's being attributed to the Department of Justice advice.
Chair Dembrough, Senator Gelser, I apologize. I work in the natural resources section. I'm not familiar with the specifics there. Again, as Judy Gears said at the opening, we acknowledge that there are problems that have developed in certain areas related to trying to make sure that there's sufficient transparency to understand how to resolve issues like you've described. We believe that the tool of requiring our legal advice to be summarized and waiving the attorney-client privilege, especially in a form that applies across the board to the entire state, to every order, to every rulemaking at all times, is too large a hammer, if you will, to solve that problem. And that I think probably the better way is to identify those individual problems where there's an issue like that, and then try to work together with the agencies and with the Department of Justice and figure out how do we get at the root issue so that there's not a black box or a black hole. I mean, I completely understand the frustration. I will say in the rulemaking process, there is the requirement that was cited earlier that agencies are citing the basis for their rules. And so they are explaining where their authority comes from. They're required to do that as part of the rulemaking. And I will finally say, I use the term opponent only because I'm thinking of it down the line where we are defending agencies in challenges to the rules. So that's the natural place for us to think about the impacts of this bill is what it's going, you know, how it's going to play out when we get to the point where someone is an opponent. I acknowledge in the rulemaking process along the way, the agencies are trying to collect public comment, consider all the viewpoints, and reach the best public policy decision.
Just follow up, Mr. Chair. One, again, I'm not talking about the orders, I'm talking about the rules, and one of the questions in my mind is whether we amended the bill to proactively state that providing a summary of that advice around the rulemaking itself doesn't constitute a waiver of privilege. It seems like we could do something like that. But I just have to push back on the idea of the black box not existing. The black box exists. I don't blame the Department of Justice for this, but I know in the work that we're doing in the Department of Human Services, DOJ is bent over backwards to try to help resolve the problems. But time and again, the Department of Justice says, we wish we could help more, but we can't because of attorney-client privilege. This is not a criticism of the Department of Justice, who has been incredibly helpful. But DOJ is limited in where they can help, and that's frustrating to me, because when I think of a Department of Justice, I think of a Department of Justice that serves the people of Oregon, not an agency of the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Thank you. This question is directed at Judy, first at least. I'm wondering if it would be at all helpful, and it seems like it would be, if at least agencies were, instead of maybe a summary, which is apparently objectionable to some, were required to cite the statutes, cases, or other documents upon which they relied or to arrive at their decisions, whether they be orders or rules. And I kind of like the idea that Senator Gelser came up with on the rule thing. So I just wonder what your response would be.
No, I think it's
Judy.
The attorney, Ms. Gears.
Well,
I'm Judy. Oh.
I'm sorry. I was trying to verify.
Ann.
Okay, I meant
Mary
you.
Oh,
I'm sorry. I got the names mixed up. You.
Chair Denbrough, Senator Thatcher. I think that's a really great idea, and I think there's a lot that could be done. I appreciate Senator Gelser's acknowledgement of the black box, because we've just found that when an agency is doing a rulemaking, they're kind of functioning a little bit like a judge. You know, they're collecting comments, and they're making decisions, and it's really frustrating. Excuse me, as a somebody that represents regulated entities, when we are almost arguing against an unknown, when we're pretty sure that we have the legal authority for the agency to do something that we think would be good for everybody, and the agency's like, well, we can't do that because DOJ said we couldn't. And I'm like, can I just talk to DOJ? Because I'm pretty sure you can. You know, I have different legal authorities, and you can submit those to the agency and then up to the commissions. And I think sometimes they do make it through to DOJ, and the process happens that way. But there is a little bit of a difficulty when you're kind of arguing against an unknown, and it stops conversations, or in some cases, I think, has enacted policy where, you know, we weren't able to have a full discourse around what the state of the law is, and why a statute should or shouldn't be interpreted a certain way. And I do work with the natural resources industries, so that are entities, so that's a lot of what my experience is based on. But I do think I've heard that it's similar across a lot of state agencies. And I do think that there's, whether it's citing authorities or a quick summary, but then that is not, you know, able to be a basis for challenge or something like that, that would give a little more understanding where it would enable even a commission to ask some more pointed questions of the agency of, hey, there seems to be a disagreement here. You know, what is that, and why can't we resolve it, and why isn't the position of, you know, for example, the Farm Bureau or somebody else correct? And so I think some of that discourse is missing in the current process, and I think your idea would be a definite step in the positive direction.
Thank you. I think,
and Mr. Chair,
yes,
I'm sorry.
Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mary Ann. No, I wouldn't mind if you would feel at all comfortable, Judy, in giving a response. Is that okay, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Is that okay?
Sure. We should wrap this up soon, but okay. Yes, please.
I think that there is probably a way to create the sort of information that Marianne would like to have, and that the committee would like to have, and that the legislature would like to have, about the legal, not the legal advice, the final legal analysis that went into a particular agency action.
So the justification for that.
Yeah, there's probably a way that can be done without waiving the attorney-client privilege. It might be something as simple as describing it carefully and then saying, this does not waive the attorney-client privilege. And we'd be happy to work on that. You know, we sometimes would like to release the advice. Sometimes agencies would actually like to release the advice, but they know if they release advice on this issue, they're going to have to release something else, and that's a problem. And so if there's some way for us to work together to create a vehicle to create this kind of information that would help everybody, we're happy to work with that. We just don't think that this particular change in the law is the right way to get there.
Thank you for that, Ms. Gears. You know, I think we would all agree we don't want to see agencies justifying their decisions simply because, well, DOJ told us to do this. that really doesn't satisfy the public interest. So we can't vote on this today, colleagues, anyway, because we don't have the appropriate paperwork for it. So let's mull over it over the next couple of days and see where we are. Okay. Thank you very much, all
Thank
of you,
you.
For
Thank
coming
you.
Forward.
Is the work session carried over?
The work session, I will carry over the work session until Thursday. And I will close the, okay, let me close the public hearing, open the work session on this bill, what was the number, 1579, and I will carry it over until Thursday. Thank you. Now I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1579 and open our public hearing on Senate Bill 1526 and ask Senator Bartschinger to come up, please, while Jan tells us about this bill. And, Senator, thank you for your patience. And actually, since we have Representative Evans here, why don't you come up as well? Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure appropriates $9 million from the general fund to support the Oregon Employer Workforce Training Program, the Youth Work Experience Programs, and grants for Oregon Community Stewardship Corps and the Summer Conservation Corps. It declares an emergency, and there's no amendments today.
Okay. Senator Bartschinger, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee. My name's Herman Bartschinger. I represent Senate District 2. I also have a place at the Education Committee along with some of my other colleagues sitting up here today. And in that committee, we talk a lot about K through 12, how to give these kids some opportunities, get them through school, what we can do. And we also talk about college. How can we extend opportunities for these young people to get in college, how to pay for it? And it's all real good stuff. But one of the things I think we fall short of is that group, especially young people, that really don't want to go to college. They want to go into the workplace. They want to start a career. And that's why I've brought this bill forward. CTE is very important. I know so many people that have benefited. And I think the old analogy of white-collar jobs are better than blue-collar jobs is not so much true anymore. Blue-collar jobs can pay a lot of money. It has become more skilled labor, not just manual labor, as it was probably referred to years ago. And I think it is time that we look at education, how to get people on with their lives so they can be successful, so they can benefit themselves and improve themselves, is not just going to college, but going to do what you want to do in this world. And so I really appreciate you bringing this bill forward and hearing it today. I'll kind of put on my hat from being an employer for over three decades. Many times when I was doing job applications and people were applying for jobs in my company, I wasn't always looking for somebody that may have already done that job somewhere else or have said that they have that skill. A lot of times I was looking for a person that I could see the ambition, somebody that will come to work every day, somebody that will dedicate themselves, and I'll train them. And as they gain skills, as they become more effective in the workplace, as they are more of a benefit of the company, then their wages will reflect that. And it has worked time after time after time. And I've, unfortunately, over the years, I've lost a lot of good employees that went on to other companies that could pay them more, that I trained them, our company. So the vocational training, whether it's going to a college or apprentice program or partnershiping with other companies or corporations, or even the Youth Corps. Youth Corps is great. Sometimes all that teaches them is how to be responsible, how to come to work, have a work ethic. Those are all good. So I really appreciate you bringing this forward, and I hope that we get it passed and funded.
We can pass it, no problem. Yeah, thank you for that, Senator Bertrier. And again, thank you for bringing it forward. We'll have questions after we hear from sure. Representative Evans. You know, I do want to say that one of the elements of the bill is to provide funding to the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, and Representative Evans is the House representative on the OYCC board. Is it a board? Whatever. I'm the Senate representative. So, yes, Representative Evans, welcome.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. Before I begin with my prepared remarks, I have to say that you have a lot more fun in this committee than we do in our House committee. You're talking about black boxes. You're talking about Roman legions and centurions. And I just... Clearly, we have some things to learn. I am Representative Paul Evans. I represent House District 20, which is Monmouth, Independence, West Salem, and South Salem. And I have the privilege of serving with the chair on the advisory committee. But this particular thing is actually, for me, more than just a good policy, though it is a good policy. Once upon a time in a land not that long ago, I worked for State Representative John Schoon in this building. And one of his achievements, and he was a long time fighting for Voc Ed in those days, now it's called CT, of course, he actually helped bring about the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps. So I actually asked for the opportunity to serve on this because I believe in it so strongly. He also was a veteran. He spent close to 25 years or more in the Marine Corps. And he recognized that some young folks, just need the opportunity to learn how to work with other young folks out in the woods, and learning how to show up on time, how to facilitate getting a project done. And ultimately, he got to see the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps established in Oregon. The Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, OYCC as it's known, is one program that would benefit from the bill, as previously talked about. I'm really here to talk about that. The Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, of course, is funded through the Lottery's Amusement Device Tax. Still trying to say that fast appropriately, Lottery Amusement Device Tax. It's approximately $2.1 million per biennium and has both a summer conservation corps and a community stewardship corps component. Basically, it is paid job experiences for youth in their own countries working on, or in their own counties working on resource projects. 64,000 project hours were completed just last summer, with over 600,000 in wages going to 367 youth. I say that, and this is an important piece. I actually teach at Chemeketa Community College, and I can tell you firsthand, as I'm sure the chair can, that this generation of folks coming in, this generation of students coming in, do not have the same level of work experience that previous generations had. The Community Stewardship Corps is, of course, a school year program that assists schools with alternative approaches to connect education, conservation, and job experience. During the 14-15 school year, I believe 48 diplomas and 13 GEDs were awarded through this program. I'd like to show you, I believe they're going to actually show you a video, but before I go, I just want to say, whatever you can do to help support this program, every life we change and move from one side of the ledger to the other is another dream that's made possible. And I just appreciate your consideration for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative.
Program that develops and builds youth through education and workforce development.
They said I would be working with at-risk kids. And I said, what does that mean, at-risk of what? They said they're at risk of not graduating, at risk of not getting employed. And so most of the youth, they're intelligent, they're bright. They just need a little more support and a little more stability in their life to get some traction.
One of the main pieces of an OYCC program is experiential learning and hands-on education.
The work is just work like any other work. You know, you're digging trench, you're moving dirt, but the learning from it is really valuable.
Most of these kids, this is their first work experience, so it's a great opportunity for us to teach them about what the workplace is like and set up those expectations.
They earn money, but they are gaining valuable skills in how to show up to work on time, how to come prepared, how to be a team player.
They can write a resume. They can interview. They know how to talk.
They are getting an incredible amount of work done. What's really wonderful to see is it's all kinds of work. It's not just in one area.
It's a hard labor, in a way. It's fun, you get to learn new things.
It's a pain in the butt, but at the end of the day, you're so proud of yourself.
We also have the Community Stewardship Corps, which is a school-based program where we work with 25 to 30 alternative high schools and middle schools, where part of their education takes place in the classroom and part of it takes place out in the field.
I think it's an incredible organization that gives students opportunities through the year and through the summer to do meaningful work for their community and for the environment. We help them develop the skills and tools necessary to be successful, and we expose them to a wide variety of career paths.
They're earning credits right now. Oregon has a service learning graduation requirement, as well as sort of a career tech graduation requirement, and these kids are meeting those. And they also can fulfill their elective credits through the OICC program.
Ever since I've been in OICC, it's kind of brought my mindset to actually wanting to graduate high school now.
What's an estuary?
What I try to do is create the culture where kids understand that high school is not the end. I'm trying to make you into a lifelong learner, because what you might want 20 years from now is not what you want today, and you want to be able to have the skill set to do what you want to do then.
I think it's really going to get me ready for like the type of work that I want to do.
They can give back to the community by building a greenhouse, or by teaching younger students, or by restoring a native stream bank. And those kinds of things, I think, have powerful and indelible impacts that stay with them for their entire life.
The combination of working out in the natural world, of working as a team and connecting to each other, and that confidence that arises in oneself is pretty profound transformation to see.
On paper, it says that I'm not very adept for the learning world. But out here, it's totally different.
Thank you. Before we take questions from the dais, I just want to say that when I saw that Senator Bertschinger had submitted this bill, I started salivating, to be grossly candid, because one of the real frustrations for me from the last, we all have frustrations every session, but one of my real frustrations was that we weren't able to fund the package of youth employment programs that we had hoped to. And, you know, we were able to put a lot of money into CTE, which is great. CTE is very, very important. But, CTE without a work experience component isn't nearly as valuable as it is with. And so, this is getting us another shot to try to get this through, because I think it really does need to be a priority. So with that, and let me also say, some of you may wonder why the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission is involved here, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, because aren't we talking about youth here? But the primary reason is because we're talking about the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, which is part of the HEC, and that's where some of these programs will run through. So with that, any questions for the senator and the representative?
Lots, but I'll wait.
Okay. All right, well, thank you both very much
for
being here. All right, I'm going to call up our next panel, and I'm delighted to call up Commissioner Loretta Smith, my commissioner from Multnomah County, and Andrew McGough, and Joe McFerrin, please. So, Commissioner, I hear you have an interest in summer youth employment. Is that true, or is that
yes,
just
sir.
A rumor?
I think it's true.
Okay, if you could give your name for the record, please. And thanks for your patience, by the way.
Thank you. My name's Loretta Smith. I'm a Multnomah County Commissioner for District 2. And I want to thank you, Senator Denbrough, for bringing this to a hearing. This is huge. Youth employment for me has been a priority for 5 years since I was elected. And listening to everything that everyone said before we got here about basically setting the stage, having a work ethic, knowing how to be someplace at a specific time. So just to take you back in time, in 2011, the county had no paid youth employment program for high school students, 16 to 24. And that's when I met Andrew in Work Systems, and we partnered with them We pay two-thirds of the freight. The federal government through Work Systems Development Board paid the other third. So we're talking about $3,000 a kid, 180 hours, 6 weeks during the summer. And the reason why I do this is because I think it is important. I don't think it's not either or, CTE or summer jobs. It's both. We need to have a parallel track, because without a work experience or a work site, you will not be able to have that opportunity to have real life experiences. So what we've done at Multnomah County, we actually place, we have 250 kids that we pay for today. We went from 25 kids to 250 kids, general fund money. 125 of the kids are paid for with lottery dollars for economic development. But we place 125 of those kids in departments at Multnomah County throughout our entire system, from the libraries to DCHS to DCJ, and all the commissioners have one. And so for me, it is very selfish in a way, because I know the baby boomers will be retiring in the next 5 years. Our 6,000 employees, almost half of them will be eligible for retirement. And yes, I want these kids from the ages of 16 to 24. They come back to us after they graduate from high school and go to college, and they still have a job. They have networked. Now they have set a stake into something. Every local government in the next 5 years, they're going to be losing a workforce. Working with low-income students, underserved students, this is how we're going to be able to fill that gap. If we don't fill that gap with those folks, I mean, I was on a conference call with the vice president about labor shortage in the future. We know that we need to get these folks in the queue. Being able to do that through your bill, it is a huge opportunity to have youth employment statewide. I mean, I just don't know if there's any other issue that is greater. And just one piece of this, when we start talking about African-American men, the employment rate from 16 to 24, 12%. In our metropolitan area, from the ages of 16 to 19, we have 36,000 youth who are not in school or who are not working. We could conceivably take all of our general fund budget to basically pay for this, but we need some help. And I think there is no better way to you know, kind of take this divide between urban and rural. The same issues that the senator talked about who dropped the bill is that rural students, rural young people have the same issues as urban folks like we do in Multnomah County. And this would be an excellent opportunity to bridge that gap between rural and urban. So I thank you, and I do support you for this bill and anything that I could do to be helpful and raise the volume up on this. Please let me know. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Andrew.
Thank you, Chair.
Again. Yeah. You're no stranger to this committee, we're happy to say.
I know I'm like the workforce nerd. but thank you very much, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is Andrew McGough. I'm the Executive Director of Work Systems. We're the Workforce Development Board for the Portland metropolitan area. And I just kind of want to echo a lot of what everyone's been saying. So I'll talk a little bit of specifics around our program, just to give you some sense of how it works and some scale and some opportunities, I think, that are definitely scalable statewide. I think that is something that we shouldn't overlook. We started this program in 2009 through a grant from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the ARRA grant. And the interesting thing is that many years ago, again, here's my workforce nerd hat, there used to be a separate funding title for summer jobs. It was over $1 billion invested by the federal government back in the 90s, but with the transition to the new Workforce Act, that funding title went away. But for many, many years, almost 40 years, there was a dedicated federal funding stream to serving and getting kids connected to jobs. So, but since we got the ARRA resources, and so that's around 2009, we served about 3,500 kids under our program, which we call Summer Works. These kids have done everything from, you know, removing invasive plants to building ships. A couple years ago, we partnered with an organization, and the kids built these sailboats, 16-foot sailboats. And one of the most interesting things is when I went down there, there was a kid, and they were planing a rectangular board, and they were actually applying Pythagorean's theorem to plane the mast on the ship. And this is a young kid who had dropped out of school but reconnected through a GED program, and finally the light bulb was going off. So it's those kinds of experiences that these summer activities offer, and we do a whole wide array of them. Those kids have earned several millions of dollars. And the other things that kids do is, you know, when you're talking about low-income kids, oftentimes they're actually helping out with family budgets and whatnot, but they also spend their money in their neighborhoods. So as these kids earn money, they go out and spend it in the local neighborhood stores, which helps the economy in general. So we know that there's a multiplier effect. When you invest in that kid, he gets a wage, he goes out and he spends it locally, everybody benefits. So in the beginning, we were pretty much on our own. I mean, we had the federal resources, and we went off, and we had enough money to serve quite a few kids, and it was complicated enough trying to figure out how to do it. But since 2009, we've built an amazing partnership, and I'm here with Commissioner Spith because she is our true champion. She really has laid down the gauntlet for her community, for her peers, for the business world. And that's what you need, is you need people in high-profile positions that go out and they advocate for these things because they matter and they work. So last year, we had more than 40 investing partners. So the other thing, I think, message to take away from that is when you make an investment, it begets other investments. People are really interested in this. Now, it's a slog, I'll be honest with you. It's hard to go out there and convince businesses and convince other public entities. But once they experience it, it's like they come back. And so now we have over 40 investing partners, and last year we served 672 youth. So it's a lot of kids, a lot of partners. 81% of the kids served were low income, and 74% were kids of color. 90% of the work sites that we worked with said this was great, they'd do it again, and they'd recommend it to their colleagues. So these are kids with, you know, sometimes perception problems, sometimes, you know, they're just not, people just aren't sure. But once it happens, folks realize, wow, this is a great, great way to get, you know, diverse talent into my organization and to engage with the younger generation. I guess I would say, just to piggyback on what the commissioner mentioned, despite this success, we do have over 36,000 kids, young people in our region who are not connected to work and they're not connected to school. So we're not quite sure what they're doing, but they're not doing important things. So figuring out ways to re-engage them is really important. You know, and at the same time, again, to sort of bring this up, we've got this, you know, huge opportunity because of this shift in the demographics, because of pending retirements. I mean, we're projecting about 50,000 replacement jobs over the next 10 years in Multnomah County, related to just our targeted industry sectors. So that's healthcare, that's manufacturing, that's IT, and that's construction. So these are jobs that pay great wages, but they don't require a college degree. I would agree with the senator earlier, but they do require some level of experience and skill training beyond secondary education. So huge opportunity, and the real, I guess, takeaway for me is this is a team sport, and we'd really love to get the state on the roster. So thanks a lot. Happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Andrew. Joe, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Senator Dimbrough, members of committee, my name's Joe McFerrin. I'm the president and CEO of Portland OIC and the Rosemary Anderson High School. We are a provider for youth, high-risk youth, who have had challenges in the public school system. Our core services are alternative ed. So we contract with 5 school districts in Portland and in East Multnomah County. For the past 20 or so years, we have been a provider and partner with Work Systems, Inc. To prepare young folks for the world of work. I have worked with Commissioner Smith for the last 4 years in partnership to give young people who, for all intents and purposes, are headed on a path that will lead them to be dependent on public services and try to get them on a path of self-sufficiency. In our schools, we are more than 80% kids of color. Over 90% of our kids are on free or reduced lunch. I often say in this line of work, I've been in this line of work for 20 years. I often say that a job experience is the best social service program in America. I cannot emphasize to you, being on the ground, working with kids who are coming from families where there's tons of despair and oftentimes generational poverty, how impactful a work experience can be. I've seen it firsthand. I started my career as a case manager, and I worked with EnviroCorps and AmeriCorps, and I went out just like in the video and worked side by side with kids who were gang impacted and had no hope to graduate from high school, let alone college or get on a career track. I am in full support of this bill. I have seen it firsthand. So many lives changed. As a result of SummerWorks and other work training programs that we've worked together with, I have seen now young adults working in school districts who were once on the way to dropping out of high school. I see young adults now working for Multnomah County, working for the city, working for Providence, working for Nike, who were technically, and some were on the pathway to the penitentiary, to be quite frank, given their background and given their home surroundings. You know, if it was appropriate, I'd get on top of this table and start jumping up and down. but let me be real clear, as an alternative education school provider, and we serve over 500 kids a year. The kids who have work experiences graduate. The kids who have work experience graduate. We also work closely with juvenile justice. And I work very close with the OIA and trying to figure out how to deal with disproportionate representation in the criminal justice system. And if you go to OIA or if you go to detention right now, I can guarantee you that not very many of those children have had a work experience. And so, I fully support this bill. I think it's the way to inspire kids in education. It's through work. It's one of our secret methods. And the last thing I'll say, you know, in addition to, you know, things like just self-worth and a sense of self-efficacy and just maybe learning about a particular industry, networking with adults, feeling important, there's also a practical issue. You know, where are we going to eat? You know, how are we going to pay rent? I mean, in some cases, these young people have to help their families. So it gets down to bare bones in many cases. It's not just about a wonderful work experience. It's also can be a very practical matter that's very important to our communities. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Joe. Questions, colleagues, or comments? I do have one question. You know, Andrew, yes, you are known as the Oregon workforce nerd, but, you know, you also interact a lot at the national level, right? And I think you have some high office in some organization. To what extent is this a national problem? And, you know, as you said, there used to be a lot of federal investment in this, mm-hmm. which has gone away, and presumably the states have had to largely pick up the slack a lot, working together with industry partners. Do you see things happening elsewhere in the country that, you know, can be good models for us? And et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would respond by saying that this is a national issue. This is not unique to Oregon. Youth, you don't really call it youth unemployment. It's really what percentage of youth are engaged in the workforce. So it's really like what percentage of kids are actually who want to work are working. And right now, despite the turnaround in the economy, that number is the lowest it's ever been recorded. And they started recording that number just after World War II. And it's a national phenomenon, and in large part, it's an international phenomenon. Lots of states. The U.S. Conference of Mayors is the organization that I work with a little bit, and they put out a publication, and they had 40 different programs from 40 different cities across the country that they highlighted in this. So it's everything from very, very small cities all the way up to the very largest. New York City has a program, and they served about 55,000 kids last summer. You know, one of our challenges in Oregon is we don't have the employer base and the kind of corporate headquarters that a lot of places enjoy. Even though we're blessed with companies like Nike and Intel and others in our region, they have a separate way of engaging. I'm not saying that's a problem. It's just it's different in Oregon. I was looking at, because I'm kind of competitive around this stuff, and my friend in Louisville, which is a relatively, it's slightly smaller than Portland, but his geographic area is about the same. They had 4,200 work experiences in Louisville last year. And again, they have very strong champions both at the local and the state level. Connecticut is famous for state investments in youth employment. New York, obviously, you can't do 55,000 jobs without some significant state investment. So, again, yes, this is a national phenomenon. Many states are stepping up, and I have all faith that Oregon is going to do the same. Yeah.
Thank you. States and also, of course, local governments, cities yes. and counties.
And Senator Denbrough?
Yes.
We have federal dollars. The Workforce Investment Act money is the money that goes through Andrew's shop. So the feds, they do recognize and understand that this is a priority.
Thank you. Okay, thank you all for coming forth and
thank you.
Sharing with us. Thank you. All right, I'm going to call up Ken Madden and Christina Payne, please. Lead off?
Sure.
Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you.
Oh, thank you, Chair Demereaux and the rest of the committee. My name is Ken Madden, and I'm the chair of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board for the state of Oregon, also commonly known as the OWIB. In addition, I own a family business called Madden Industrial Craftsman and Madden Fabrication, a steel fabrication facility. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak before the committee today. As chair of the OWIB, last year we finished a strategic plan, a four-year strategic plan, and number four of that strategic plan speaks specifically to the youth unemployment and how we prioritize that for the state of Oregon. Now, speaking as an employer, I can tell you how important that is as an employer. My company, Madden Industrial Craftsman, is a staffing company, and so we supply skilled trades to a lot of the employers within the Portland area all the way up to the Seattle area. There's a skills gap when it comes to skilled trades currently, and not only in Oregon but across the nation. So one of the things we're trying to do is get more people into the trades. And youth, with the high youth unemployment rate in the state of Oregon and nationally, that is one targeted group that we're looking at bringing in. I can speak, you know, on my behalf of my own company, we've started training some of our recruiters to be senior or more experienced recruiters, and we started with the youth. That multi-generational has made us a stronger company. It's amazing. They come with a lot of skill sets that the older generation don't have and possess, especially when it comes to social marketing, social recruiting, tools that are unique to that group. But bringing that technology into our company has taught us how to recruit to that other base, which we haven't really had the experience before we started doing that program. So.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Christina?
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name's Christina Payne, and I am the Executive Director of Lane Workforce Partnership, which is the local workforce board in Lane County. I am also the current chair of the Oregon Workforce Partnership, which is a membership of primarily directors from the workforce boards, the 9 workforce boards covering the North Coast, South Coast, Rogue Region, Salem area, Lane County, Central Oregon, Clackamas, Eastern Oregon, and Portland. And so I'm here today to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 1526, which, if I understand, if passed, this bill would provide funds to local boards to fund local employment opportunities for youth, as we've been hearing the testimony today on the importance of work experience for youth. When we talk about, we use the term youth a lot, and we're talking about individuals age 16 to 24. And so really, we're talking about young adults that need more experience in working. I have these conversations a lot with people like Ken and other business owners who a lot of times are surprised at the lack of work experience and work ethic that young adults have as they're coming into work. And we find that really they haven't had an opportunity to work and to fail. We all learn through some form of failure at one point in time in our lives, and hopefully it's when we're young, because the younger you are, the less the failure can have an impact on the effects of so many other aspects of your life. And when we're talking about young adults, we're also talking about individuals who a lot of times are already taking care of small children, whether it be their own child or a sibling or a neighbor of some sort, for whatever reason that situation has put them in. And so a lot of times we don't really have a good idea of the type of person that we're serving. We see some of the profiles in the videos that the video that you saw today, but there are a lot of young people living in Oregon that are just simply going underserved. And we tend, in our work, we have tended to rely primarily on the federal dollars. It was the Workforce Investment Act. Now it's the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. And I've learned through Andrew a lot. I've been watching what he's done. In my second year as a director, I realized that strictly relying on those resources just simply isn't enough. It's not enough. And so that's why I'm here today. I hope the state can find the funds to invest in training for youth, because it is a game changer for youth. It makes a difference if they can go to work and have that experience, and they need to be paid while doing this to demonstrate that their work has value and that there is value being placed on what they're doing. It's not that just because they're young and they're learning that they shouldn't be paid, but this is something that is of value. The skills, they learn communication skills and learning to work with others on teams. They learn the importance of showing up on time, which I'm sure we hear over and over and over again. Why can't people do that? And they should already know. But they don't necessarily know why. Some people can do it without knowing why. There is a large population that needs to know why. And sometimes just through that experience alone, you can learn why it's important to show up on time. I want to focus on my next point. I do have some profiles of some individuals who are currently being served in the WIOA program. And just to give you an idea of the background, so we've got a 17-year-old who suffers from severe anxiety, low income, and no work experience. Some of the services this person is accessing, they've earned their National Career Readiness Certificate at the silver level. They've gone through a Win at Work program. They've gone through financial literacy counseling. And they have a work experience placement through the current federal program. Their goals, one of the biggest goals, hurdles this individual had to overcome was being able to leave their home and catch a bus because of the anxiety. They can now do that. They can get on the bus. They can go to work, and they're working through these issues. Another one was basic skills deficient, low income, and a high school dropout. They've registered for alternative school. They've received a modified high school diploma and their food handler's card. They'd like to go to school at Lane Community College, and will be able to enroll in credit courses by spring of 2016. And then a final one is an 18-year-old who's a parent, basic skills deficient, low income, and a high school dropout. He's now registered for alternative school and currently enrolled in the GED program. So all I'm saying is if we don't come together as a system and build off the federal resources to better serve youth and provide them with paid work experience and other work development services, we will not be building a statewide workforce system in Oregon. And I'm afraid that we will continue to leave our youth behind. Businesses will not be able to fill high-paying positions that only require a high school diploma or possibly a certificate. And youth will continue to remain unemployed, go in debt, require state subsidies to pay for food and other bills. It becomes a vicious cycle. And together, I think we can break this cycle.
Thank you very much, Christina. I just want to, first of all, say that something that you mentioned reminded me that we didn't hear specifically from the previous panel about the kind of supports that can come when you're talking about a youth employment program. I mean, sometimes just the fact of having a job is benefit enough. But for some kids, they need some, you know, support and, you know, mentoring, whatever. And, you know, and these programs often provide that.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could just touch on how that might work.
Thank you, Senator Denbrough. Yeah, that is a very good point. It's not just about finding the work experience placement. It's about ensuring that the individual has access to quality child care and the ability to get their child to and from a child care center or someone to care for their child. It's about transportation. It's it could be that there's a certain required clothing for work. And we talk a lot of times about expensive tools and boots, but sometimes it's the appropriate pair of pants that fit and a shirt that comes all the way down and covers someone's stomach. And so there are all types of things and the counseling that goes along with that individual to ensure that they're successful on the job.
Colleagues, any questions for this panel? Yeah, I do want to say that so the Workforce Investment Board, which, you know, as you know, is we have a variety of interests who are sitting on the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. Most of the majority have to be business from the business community. But we do have some legislators on. Senator Rosenbaum used to serve on that committee, and then we lowered our standards, and I replaced her. Representative Polvey on the House side and Representative Post on the House side. But we haven't had a senator from the Republican Party since Senator George left us. Mm. So. Now, does that mean that you have to be on it, Senator Thatcher? Not necessarily.
I'd be happy to be.
but I think we should talk about that because we really, it's been a while since we've had our fourth
legislator. Demarone, if I may. I, first of all, I wanted to thank you for being such an active member on the OWEB board. Your input's been very, very important to our board. And Senator Rosenbaum started with me, or at least I started with her, when I first joined the OWEB board too, so I'd also appreciate your efforts with the board, and you know, we're more than welcome to take as many people who want to be a part of the board that we can fit on the board. But I do appreciate the efforts. We are an important board. We do a lot of work when it comes to workforce training, and youth are a very critical part of that portion of it, and so getting the word out of the work of our board is very important, but I do also very much appreciate your assistance.
Thank you very much. And the executive director of the board, Melissa Leone, is in the audience, and Melissa, I suggest you get in touch with Senator Thatcher quickly. Okay, thank you both.
Yes,
very much.
Thank you.
We have one last person who's signed up, and that's Tim Cowan. Would you please come up, Mr. Cowan?
Chair Dembrough, committee members, I can do mine in 2 minutes or less. Since it was brought up, I have a picture of Governor Goldschmidt and myself.
Sorry, Tim, you have to give us your name, please.
Tim Cowan, sorry. I have a picture of me and Governor Goldschmidt holding up a sign on Youth Conservation Corps, and it was done for providing jobs in Salem, and John Schoon worked for me. Now, and I'm not going to answer questions on my age either.
You're not under oath.
I'm involved in reducing the cost of a college degree, student loans, and refinancing those student loans. So to the bill. It says I would like the Higher Education Coordinating Commission for the Office of Community College to include reporting to you on reintegration between K through 12 and the community college, because I think there's an opportunity maybe to reduce the amount of classes they have to take their first year. I think it's more efficient, and it improves entry into the college because the classes are done in a familiar environment. And I think it helps people when it's their first opportunity for the family to attend college. All in there.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim. Any questions? Let's go. Okay, thanks for coming forward with that suggestion. Okay, well, that's it. So I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1526. Colleagues, we do have the paperwork on this, and I would be pleased to have us send it to Ways and Means, where it will have its next step.
Okay. Did you open the work session?
Not yet.
Okay.
So I'm going to open a work session then on Senate Bill 1526. Vice Chair Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1526 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you. Vice Chair Thatcher moves Senate Bill 1526 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Colleagues, any discussion? Again, before we vote on it, I want to thank Senator Bertschinger for bringing it forward. I know that this was a priority. I believe it's a priority of our Republican colleagues, and I believe that it's a priority, or it will be once they know about it, of our Democratic colleagues as well. This is really very important. So with that, any other comments? Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion passes, and Senate Bill 1526 heads to Ways and Means. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1526. Colleagues, before we adjourn, so Thursday, I think we can anticipate a long floor session, or there's a chance if the minimum wage bill is on the docket, and it may eat into our committee time, depending on how things go. So if you would be prepared for a potential brief evening hearing, the hope is that the wage enforcement bill, the consensus amendments will be completed by then, and we'll be ready to vote on it. If not, if we're able to get out early from the floor, then hopefully we'll be able to do it at our regular time. My understanding is that the minority report is 72 pages long, so perhaps we could have our meeting during the reading of that, but I don't believe we can. So anyway, just stay. I would ask that you stay flexible. So with that, colleagues, we are adjourned.
Are we going to have committee yoga if we're going to stay flexible? Are we going to have committee yoga if we're going to stay flexible?